Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
Did you know you can save money with the McDonald's app every single day? Yeah, I was surprised too. Deals every day right at your fingertips. I love a good deal, but the McDonald's app takes gaming the system to a whole new level. Just the other day, I treated myself to a 10-piece chicken nugget for only a dollar. Yeah, you heard that right. Just $1. All you have to do is order in the app. And get this, you can grab that deal once a week through December 2nd. The first time I discovered the deals in the app, I was honestly shook. I had to tell my whole group chat about it, and now we're always comparing who got the best app deal of the week. Plus, ordering ahead, total game changer, especially when I need a quick lunch or a treat after a long day. So why wait? Save money every day with the McDonald's app. Download it, get those deals, and treat yourself. You deserve it. Valid through December 2nd, 2024 at participating McDonald's. Offer valid one time per week. Excludes delivery, and you must opt into rewards. So go check out McDonald's deals. And observe this, brother.
All right.
Too bad I only get to hear that once a month.
The Double G here with the very happy Brandon Draven. And, you know, for people who for some reason don't pay attention to real sports, Draven's favorite baseball team just won the World Series. This doesn't happen often, people. So unfortunately, his favorite baseball team is my most hated baseball team, but you got to call it how you see it. Dodgers, best team in the league, beat the Yankees in five. How are you feeling, man? I imagine it's fantastic right now.
Hold on. Let me replug here. I feel great. I mean, what do you want me to say? I mean, it's a monkey off our backs, right? 1,000 monkeys off our backs. I don't want to hear none of this 2020 half-title bullshit anymore.
Okay, can I actually ask
you about that? Yes, I should say, because we're on YouTube.
But, okay, so I thought that was just us Giants fans like razzing you guys, but that was actually a thing.
Well, it's a thing with people that wanted to get under my skin. I mean, it was such a like low hanging fruit, way to get to me. You know what I'm saying? And it's like, to me, every team in baseball had a chance that year. It's like it wasn't tailor made for the Dodgers, so it counts. It counts. I don't care if it was half a season or whatever. Yeah. But that doesn't matter now. Because we got what you guys would say a real one now. So yeah, I'm on a Friday morning. I'll be there at the parade and having a good time.
All right. So just because this
having a good time right now with my wife.
No, you deserve it. So this will go up in the audio feed on Monday, but it's on YouTube now. People watching it live. I just wanted to mention one thing. We're going to talk about one more baseball thing, and then we'll move on. We'll talk the wrestling show that we're going to talk about. September of 1989. So Freddie Freeman hits one of the biggest hits in baseball history, one of the biggest home runs in baseball history. And it very much reminded me, like everyone, of Kurt Gibson in 1988. And so I've never shared this with you, but when I'm 12 years old, I'm a 12-year-old baseball fan. The Giants were okay that year. 87 was the one that they kind of let slip away. But I, as a young junior high school kid, I actually don't know any Dodgers fans. I just know that I'm supposed to root against them, but I only know A's fans. And so the A's fans are kind of giving it to me because the A's are supposed to easily win this World Series. So I'm not saying that I was rooting for the Dodgers in that series, but what I'm saying is after that game, like the next day at school, whenever the next day would have been, you know, if I walked over to my A's fans buddies, I was doing the the pump, like Kirk running around the bases. So compare the two moments. You were a little kid when Kirk's moment seven. Happened.
Yes.
Yeah. But now Freddie's home run happened, which was magical. It was almost Roy Hobbs-ish from The Natural, kind of with the injury and such.
Right, yeah.
But, like, compare those two moments. Like, where do you think that one, does it compare to the Kirk one? Is it bigger than the Kirk one? Like, what do you think?
Well, here's the thing about the Kirk one, as you say, Kirk one. It became a curse towards the end because for years we had been looking for some sort of highlight, right? I mean, we had the Steve Finley getting us into the playoffs against the Giants, I believe, from 2004. You know, that was played. Was it? Yeah, it was against the Giants. That was played for a long time, but we didn't win that year, so it didn't matter, right?
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, we can't use the Julio Urias one anymore because, you know, he got canceled. He's banned from baseball, you know, rightfully so, by the way. So we couldn't use that one anymore. Plus, that's the one everybody clowned us on anyway. So I was tired of seeing Kirk Gibson because that moment has become such a staple of the LA sports mythology, right? And so it's like at the end, it was almost like a joke to me anyway. That's how I saw it because it was like we need another highlight here.
Yeah.
You know, it's been 34, 35 years of the same highlight. So we got one now. We got Freddie Freeman, and it was incredible. I mean, I was watching it live. I was at a bar. He hits it out. I mean, it's the thing that dreams are made of, right? Every little kid grows up wanting to be in that situation. You know, bottom of the 10th. Mm-hmm. You know, I think he even had a full. No, he didn't have a full count. It was the first pitch. But it's interesting because me and you and any other sports fan. Baseball fan in particular, we all saw it. We all remember it. Now, as the years go on, you're going to see the myth of that day just get bigger and bigger, like any moment in sports, you know?
Yeah, the Giants have one in the NLCS, not in the World Series with my half-Japanese brother, Travis Ishikawa, who didn't even really play that season hitting one. But those moments, and Dylan, do you read Dylan Hernandez from the LA Times?
Yeah. I like all those guys, Plasky, Dylan, you know, all those guys.
So Dylan Hernandez said that when I think he was the same age as you when Kirk hit his home run. And he said that, like, he didn't understand really what it was about. But his dad, who was a very conservative, not someone who's a very outgoing person, when he saw his dad jump up and down and pick him up and carry him and jump around, he's like, oh, like, this thing is actually kind of a big deal. And I think this Freeman one is going to be the same thing for the little kids who are Dodgers fans today. So, you know, I would have rather seen you guys lose, but it didn't happen. Yeah, and you just got to roll with it. It was that was a great moment. The series itself wasn't fantastic. I think if the Yankees would have pulled it out today, there may have been some drama, but you guys are going home to win one out of two. So it wasn't like
how it is.
Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about it.
I want to focus on wrestling this weekend. I don't want to focus on watching baseball. Honestly,
dude, when the Giants won the 3-5, and when the Warriors won the 4, you're going long seasons, long games. It's like intense, and when it's over, you're happy, but you're so relieved at the same time. It's crazy.
Yes, but let me just say one more thing because I think this pertains to life in general, right? Because I had a therapy group, a therapy session, and we talked a lot because, you know, I mean, for the people that don't know, you know, I'm a therapist and I talk to a lot of people that are going through mood instability.
Yeah.
And we brought up this idea of these little, like, superficial things, right? Like sports and like hobbies and whatnot. And they are a distraction, right? And we invest in them so that we could, it's very cathartic, right? The way we connect emotionally to these teams and these activities. So they do have a purpose, you know, they do have. And so I, you know, that's why. And it's also a community experience, too. Right. Because everybody in LA tonight is celebrating. So there is definitely something that to be said about how these kind of activities bring people together. And it's also, you know, if you invest in that activity or the team or whatnot, you know, you are going to get rewarded. Right. And so that's why I think these kind of events are important. Including wrestling, by the way.
Wrestling is very much that as well. Now, and, you know, Vince McMahon used to always say, well, we can create the finishes in the way that we want them. Why would we want to actually be involved in real sports? But when you get moments like Freddie Freeman, you're like, ah, you can't write that. Like, that's perfect stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And actually, I was thinking, it's been a while since we had that kind of drama in wrestling. Maybe you could go Cody Rhodes and Roman at WrestleMania. Yeah, which
Cody's was a moment deal. Or Sting's retirement, which is still my favorite moment
yeah,
of the year.
Yes, definitely. So even though, yeah, it's written and scripted or whatever, you could definitely still create a lot of drama around it. It should be even easier, actually, you know. Now, even with AEW, I mean, I think this whole Moxley stable has a lot of potential. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's a lot of ways to create a lot of drama around this. I think that's what AEW needs. I think to complement their ability to give us great matches, right? The 5-star matches, 7-star matches, if Will Ospreay's wrestling, you know, every single match. but that's to me, that's what they're missing. They're missing that soap opera element. And with this Mox angle, there it is, you know. And if you do it right, which I think they are, I mean, I know a lot of people have complained about how they're feeding the Mox crew all these jobbers, but to me, you're protecting the baby faces while you build the heat, you know. And I was thinking about it. Think about all the little side stories that you could come off of. That you could that this angle could bring the Elite back together. Imagine that mm-hmm. moment, you know, when the Elite has to come together to fight off Mox's crew.
I know you haven't watched Dynamite yet, but there are.
I haven't.
Little things that are kind of beginning that you'll be
oh good
see.
Good yeah.
Yeah yeah
or even something like when Swerve gets involved, you know, because Swerve's kind of a lone wolf, and I'm a sucker for that angle where like the lone wolf has to kind of sacrifice his own independence for the betterment of the team, you know. That little trope always gets me. It's always pretty cool. So this angle has a lot of possibilities. I think they needed that. Of course, we're going to hear all the whole, oh, it's an NWO knockoff. It doesn't matter because that was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Eventually, yeah. Every movie, every idea is a knockoff of something else. So just give it to me and I'm excited for that. You know, anyways, let's talk about some 1989.
All right. Let's talk about some 1989 now. Some of this stuff, it's kind of funny reading it back. Like, because Dave has a lot of like the early context of what they're trying to do. And so I wanted to ask you this question. Everybody remembers Tugboat. Do you remember, did he have a last name when he came in originally?
Yes, he did. Originally, like we saw in the Observer, he was Tugboat Tyler.
Yes.
But then they switched it over to Tugboat Thomas.
Yes.
And then when he finally made TV, he was just Tugboat.
See, I remember the Tugboat Tyler. I don't remember the Tugboat Thomas, but Dave has both of those names in the Observer as who Tugboat becomes. It's just funny. Like, it's such a Vince McMahon gimmick by just calling a man by the name of an item, like of a thing. That's the man's name, because we would know him mostly as Tugboat. But that's just kind of, you know, 89, 90, 91. And then it would get worse in like 93, 94, 95 when it would just all be gimmicks. But it was just so funny reading it back. Like, oh, yeah, he did have a last name. I forgot about that.
It was one of Vince's things. And I don't know why he did this, but he would always he would always interview you. Right. Before you start in the territory. And then he would ask things about you. And then if there was some. He would always latch onto these little idiosyncrasies of the personality of the wrestlers, and then he would base a gimmick around them. So it could be something as simple as like Fred Ottman saying, I'm into boats, you know, I like boats or whatever, which I think he does, by the way, because he retired and he became like this fisherman or something. And so that could have been something like, oh, well, there's the tugboat. I could see the tugboat, and, you know, toot toot and stuff. So that's just the way Vince thinks.
Yeah,
you know, he'll make you totally. A garbage man. He'll make you, you know, all kinds of things.
I'm sure he thought, you know what? We're going to sell boats that kids could use in the bath, like little tugboats.
Or the little hats, that little hat he used to wear.
Okay, so Tugboat is a newcomer into WWF. Now, there's not a whole lot of WWF news in this month of the Observer. The other piece of news is actually the bigger news, because it kind of kicks off this idea that maybe folks in WWF are thinking about going to the other side. And the Brainbusters, who came from the other side, have given their notice, and they're going to wrestle through the Survivor Series, and then they're going to go back to the NWA. And it sounds like, it's we're in the beginning stages of it. I'm sure Dave will have so much more information when it actually happens. But it's almost like they got like double their money, I guess, to go back, which is, you know, pretty cool. To if the only reason you have leverage is because there's another company that exists, and that is why AEW and WWE competing and existing is great for wrestlers. But imagine you go to the other side for like a year and a half, and then come back. We want you. We're gonna give you double the money that you're making.
Yeah, yeah, and they needed that W, right? Because at this point in time, we're seeing a lot of the opposites, you know, happening. We're seeing a lot of NWA guys going over to Vince. So NWA needed this W to kind of show that, hey, look, we're getting people too, right? And so, yeah, they got a big race, but ultimately totally wouldn't enjoy it. And we'll talk about it next month.
Yeah, yes.
But you know, I mean, you know the story, right?
The story of Tully?
Yes.
Yes. I know that story.
That happened at Survivor Series. We'll get to it in the next episode.
Yeah. Next couple, actually. Okay, so on the WCW side, the big show is the Clash of the Champions. And this show is famous, or infamous maybe even, because of an angle at the end of the show in which Terry Funk placed a plastic bag over Ric Flair's head to suffocate him, which is the same angle that John Moxley's crew that Draven just was talking about used against Bryan Danielson at what was it? Wrestle Dream. At
the Wrestle Dream show. It was both Wrestle Dream and
All Out, right?
Yes.
Was it All Out? Yeah.
Yes.
So, you know, if I'm Bryan Danielson, I'm like, baby faces, you had one job, which is just keep that bag off my head the second time. Like, come on. But
I don't remember seeing Sting coming out and sobbing as a 12-year-old boy as he's looking at Terry Funk, smother Ric Flair with a bag, and Gary Hart is literally has a shoulder on him, not a lot. Anyways, they kind of made up for that now, but it was ridiculous at the time.
It was pretty silly. That story it's something that it sounds like. Couple of the folks in AEW really, really have been wanting to do. But even in 1989, it's not like this was like a slam dunk angle. Now, the lead up to this is Terry Funk is hurt. We'd been mentioning that he was hurt and having these like really short matches with Sting before he got to Flair. And then he lost that match. And now they're doing Flair and Funk. But Flair gets hurt again. He gets staph, and it's so bad that he's hospitalized. Now, when you hear stuff like, oh, you know, he could have lost his arm, or they would have had to amputate. Like, I don't know if that's true. It sounds gnarly. It sounds crazy to think that a staph infection could cause you to have to amputate something. But there were those discussions about Funk and how grave the injury was. But so Funk's whole the whole lead into this clash, it's supposed to be Terry Funk and the Great Muta against Ric Flair and Sting. The beginning of Clash is an interview where that reporter himself, Gordon Solie's chasing down the story of where's Funk, and we have multiple interviews with Gary Hart, and Gary Hart's kind of lying to him, and he's saying, you know, Funk is, you know, what have you heard about Funk? And, you know, where are you getting this information? And as it turns out, Gordon was right. Funk is not in the match. But Gary Hart was also right, because Funk is there. And in the main event, Terry Funk, like seemingly coming out of the hospital to do this angle with Ric Flair, like when you read the backstory of it, it makes it even more like real, yeah. in a sense. I'm sure the fans didn't really know what was going on, like what was true and what was not. But that's the part of it that I always remember, is Funk wanting this thing to work so badly that he probably left the hospital a little early just for the business. Like, that was an amazing thing
He was definitely a trooper during this time, right? I mean, he was working those 4-minute house shows with Sting, but he was hurting. I think his back was broken. It wasn't, you know, it was broken. He had a broken back. And then Ric Flair had the staph infection, like you said. One of the cool things around this time that I really, really like, and this is when they had the committee, right, when Ric Flair was the head of the committee. Mm-hmm. I like how they're starting to build around younger talent, you know? Because if you notice, the whole conversation of building around younger talent wasn't even a thing in the WWF for, what, the first 11 years of the expansion, right? I mean, because Hogan was such a big draw, they never worried about that. And you know, and Hogan, he was in his mid-30s when he was, you know, at his peak. But it wasn't until they started pushing Bret, which, you know, interesting. Bret was pretty old when he got his first push, but TV-wise, he was a young guy.
Mm-hmm.
But this whole idea about building around youth, that was never a topic of conversation when I was growing up. But here,
you know when it was? When it was in the mags. And the reason why I'm even remembering this is because one of the guys on this Clash show, Tommy Rich, right? We always heard about Tommy Rich being this really young NWA champion for a very short time. And then every time he came back, you're like, oh, the former champion, because that's how they would bill him. That's how they billed him here again. But guys like Tommy Rich or the Von Erichs, we would hear about it. But when we were watching, that was never that big of a deal.
Right. But even here, I mean, they're building around the Great Muta, you know, who got over and is young at this time. And also, this is kind of like the very, very, you know, the first time that they're really getting behind Sting.
Yeah.
You know, this is the beginning of it. So, again, Sting and Steve Austin, you have the misconceptions, you know, oh, the push came right now. It's like they had a little bit of a waiting period there from the time that we thought they were getting pushed up until the time they were actually getting pushed. And Sting, what, 88, Clash 1 mm-hmm. at this point is a year and a half ago. And just now they're starting to get them really fired up and, you know, pushing them to the top. So I like how they're intermingling all these angles, right? You merge the Great Muta and Sting. Now you're getting Terry Funk and Ric Flair involved, you know, and so, yeah, this is pretty cool because it's very intricate, you know. Compare this to the WWF that was so basic, right? Because it's a cartoon. You got to keep it basic for the kids. Step A, step B, step C. Whereas here, we're starting to see all these weavings of storylines, and it'll get better as the year goes on because the build-up to Halloween Havoc, you would see more storylines kind of come together and cross paths. So I like it, and this is a pretty fun time for me as a fan. This part of the year.
So the Clash has a bunch of matches. There's so many matches on this show. The opener is the Road Warriors against the Samoan SWAT team, and the interesting thing about this, and I think we mentioned it last time, is the Samoan SWAT team actually got a pin on the Road Warriors on a house show or two, which was not happening almost ever. And so the Road Warriors get the win here. And I think the story coming out of this is that Paul E. Dangerously and the Samoan SWAT team, they kind of they walk out on him. And this leads into him being fired later. We'll get to that in a second. But so there's like this Paul E. Dangerously is a piece of this thing. He's in this match. And then it's almost like on the screen, the team leaves him, and in reality, he's getting fired. So,
right,
not the first time that he gets fired.
No, from WCW. No. Yeah, they got out of that though. One of his firings, he settled for quite a bit of money because he just knows how to do stuff like that.
yeah, his pops.
Yes.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details. At Kroger Pharmacy, care is making it easy to get vaccinated. Care is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. Care is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
The Z-Man, the introduction of the Z-Man to WCW. We had seen him. I had seen him first as part of the Can-Am connection in the WWF. And I think it's 87. I think he's in that WrestleMania match. And the creation of Strike Force comes out of the Z-Man just bailing on WWF. And then Strike Force is kind of created out of that. So here, it was kind of weird. They're like, oh, this newcomer. And I guess he'd been working AWA or something as well. So they're trying to put him over as like this new guy. But I mean, wrestling fans would have known who he was.
Yeah, yeah. So the Z-Man, the story of the Z-Man is interesting. Like you said, he came up with Rick Martel. And what happened was that the Can-Am connection got over. Right? They were supposed to get the tag titles. And all of a sudden one day, I guess Tom Zeng's talking to one of the boys. And they're like, you know that Rick Martel makes this much money, you know, per match. And he's like, what? I want to make that money. So he goes up to Rick Martel. And Rick Martel's like, I'm the one that got us into the company. I'm the one that was the former world champion with the AWA. You know, and essentially he's just saying, you're riding my coattails. So you take what you get and I got what I got. Yeah. And so they ended up getting into a big brawl, not a fist fight, but just a big argument. And then Tom Zeng leaves. And they actually, I don't think they ever spoke again because Tom Zeng passed away a few years ago.
Yeah.
And so, Rick Martel ends up, they literally just taped a new tag team, right? It was like, here's Tito Santana, who ain't doing anything. He's your partner. And they just essentially gave the storyline of the Can-Am connection to the Strike Force.
Yeah.
And then Tom Zeng went to the AWA for a few years, and then now he went to WCW, where he would be for you know, 2-3 years as a, you know, mid-card guy, sometimes jobber.
And also, maybe the greatest guest in the history of Wrestling Observer Live on IATA.
I love that guy, man. I love that guy. But we'll never know. What's interesting about him is that we'll never know what shut him up. Because he said a lot of controversial stuff.
Yeah.
You know, very controversial. And then one day, I don't know if some, you know, he got a letter from a lawyer or what, but he just vanished from the internet. Up until the time that, you know, we found out he had passed away.
Can you imagine if he was alive right now and hadn't shut up? Like, a lot of the insinuations of things and, you know, like, I wonder if they just gave him some money and had him sign an NDA and told him to get out of here.
Yeah, that's probably what happened. But who would do it, though? Because WCW was dead at that point, and a lot of the attacks were for WCW.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, and Jim Ross. Jim Ross would get it a lot from him. You know? That was kind of like the first time that we found out that Jim Ross is actually a pretty, like, very, like, an irritable human being, you know?
Oh, I've heard a lot of Jim Ross stories of late, just because as he's getting older and, you know, people are talking about Jim, he's, like, I really enjoyed interviewing him. Dave and I interviewed him, and he was really good, and, you know, he's dealing with pain, so he was also smoking some medicinal while we were recording.
Sure.
But in person, it was a little bit of a different story. Now, it was also a little bit of a different time because it wasn't too long after his wife had passed away.
Right.
But yeah, Jim Ross in person was, you know, kind of a little bit more of the irritable guy than he was on the air, who I thought he was really charming on the air. He knows how to turn it on and you know, do that thing. So,
yeah. Yeah.
All right. Sid Vicious and Ranger Ross. Very quick match. By the way, Tom Zink beat the Cuban Assassin with a sleeper hold.
Right? They're introducing new characters, new wrestlers, which is good because that's what you want the clash for.
And that's why you can have 9 matches when you have some short ones. So Sid Vicious beats Ranger Ross. And Meltzer mentioned in his write-up that it was good for two reasons. Because A, it was a squash, so Sid looks great. And B, it was a squash so that Sid couldn't screw anything up. And we're leading to, and we'll talk about this one next month, we're leading to an insane Skyscrapers versus Road Warriors match that is at the Halloween Havoc pay-per-view. So, and they're already building Sid up at this point as like, you know, Ric Flair may have to pay attention to this guy because he may be coming for him at some point. So nice, like little teases for the near future there. Okay. The Fabulous Freebirds, who for the dirt sheet fans, not the most popular tag team champions, but for me as a kid
and me
and seeing just how over the top they were and how cool that P.S. Hayes was, I loved them as a tag team, but the newsletter, the insider people were like, oh, these guys wrestle nothing but boring matches. So it's interesting reading back in the Observer about who the Freebirds were at this point. They beat the Steiners, and this match is very memorable to me. We've been talking about this story.
We didn't get this in the Steiners biography.
No, we did not. Not the A&E one. That was a terrible biography. So Scott and Rick, they are Woman and Missy Hyatt are both of their valets and come into the ring. And the finish of this match was the camera does not actually show us exactly, but somebody, either Woman or Missy Hyatt, trips Scott into a DDT and he gets pinned and he loses the match. And so they shoot this very specifically where there's no camera angle where you can actually see who did it. Scott's blaming Woman. Rick is blaming Missy. And we are leading into this turn of Woman becoming a heel and Doom coming, and then they come for the next pay-per-view. But I for whatever reason, I remembered every little bits and pieces of the end of this match. It was so memorable, even down to the wacky camera angle that they used. I was just like, this just reminds me of childhood for whatever reason, this angle. It's still, I thought it was really good. Now, you couldn't do it today because there's a camera everywhere and fans have cameras on them. But in 1989, I thought this was really cool.
Yeah. And I mean, this is when they roll up one of the Steiners here, right, for the win?
I think she trips Scott and he falls into a DDT.
Right. And to me, I always thought, I mean, even now, like, especially now that I have more of a booker's mind, like, you're introducing the Steiners at this point who are, like, ridiculously over, right? Especially with the Frankensteiner, because people forget that the Frankensteiner took the world by storm. That was quite a finisher in that time.
Well, and at this point, it's not even a finish because when they go to Halloween Havoc, Scott pulls it out in the middle of the ring, but it's kind of like as a fire the crowd up spot rather than this is going to be our finishing move. They still were not really doing, like I was going ahead a little bit to watch that pay-per-view just because Halloween is tomorrow and I'm going to do Wrestling Observer, Fight Game Podcast. So we're going to talk about that show.
Okay.
There were not, I don't think there were really any finishing moves in any of these matches. It was just like, you know, you're using moves that are memorable, but not necessarily leading to the finish. But yeah, the Frankensteiner soon becomes like the best finishing move up to that point.
Yes. And then the Steiners were getting over because they had only been teaming since June, right? June was the Great American Bash. So I don't know, them doing the job here, and I know it was storyline progression. I know that was the whole point of it, but it was still something that I don't know. I wouldn't have done it this way. Just put it that way. But it was more. It was more for the storyline, right? For Woman and for Missy.
Well, how would you have done it?
You could still have them have the same angle, but just let that be a false finish, and then. Well, first of all, they messed up by booking themselves against the tag champs, you know, because now you book yourself into a corner. Now the young hot team has to do a job. I mean, you could always end up in a DQ. I mean, that's your thing. I guess they could have done that too. Do the angle exactly how we saw it, right? Exactly how we saw it. But that's a false finish, so you could still progress that storyline, and then have a DQ finish, you know, just to protect the Steiners.
I think one of the unique things about the Steiner brothers was Scott was kind of being positioned as this super white meat baby face. And cause he was taking all of the pins at this point. And the reason why they probably did the finish in this way is because they're setting up this new team for woman, and you want to show how evil she is. And this leads into an angle that we'll talk about next week, where Scott goes into a limo and woman is there, and it's basically a setup to beat him up. Dave was so mad at this angle, by the way. He was like, whoa, he's like, how can you just have a cameraman there shooting this thing and they don't care? They don't call the cops. Like, so this was like back when, you know, when it was real,
stuff like this.
So, you know, leading into this, like, it was, you know, it was a storyline. You could tell these storylines in slow fashion, which is what this was, because the Steiners don't even really take off until the pay-per-view, I guess, right, is when they actually get some big wins, because I think they beat the Road Warriors at the Starrcade pay-per-view.
Yeah, but everybody beat everyone in that pay-per-view except for the Wild Samoans. They didn't, or the Samoan South SWAT team. They didn't beat anybody. I think they went 0-4. What would happen is that they, if memory serves, they would beat the Freebirds. It was funny because they would beat the Freebirds at a television taping for the tag straps, but the television taping wouldn't air for another month, and they had a clash in the middle. I think it's Clash 9, which is the next one. So the Freebirds were introduced as the tag champions without the belts, because they hadn't lost them, but they couldn't say that because they hadn't been televised yet. Very awkward. When we get to it, I'll remind you. So the Steiners would eventually get the tag straps like about a few weeks after this. And then they would be on their way, you know. And again, I think with them, 90 really cemented them as a very, very legendary team because of what they also did in Japan. This is when they started going to Japan as well.
If you count the Steiners as, you know, 1989 to 1992, they're like a surefire Hall of Fame team just for those 4 years. But then they get discredited for the WWF run, which isn't fantastic. And then, you know, they kind of lose out a little bit when it comes to the Attitude Era, and Scott goes babyface. But man, those 3-4 years were awesome. They have a match with Sting and Luger at the very first Super Brawl, I think. That is like one of my favorite matches ever as a kid. It's only like 11 minutes, but it's just like big move, big move, big move, high spot, high spot, high spot. It's like one of those matches. And then they have the matches on. Remember when they were doing what did they call the New Japan WCW shows that they did like 2 or 3 of them.
Yeah,
they were called Starrcade in Japan, but then in the US they were something else.
They were WCW Super Show.
Oh, is that what it was? The Super Show. They had great matches on those shows too. So, like, just fantastic stuff. Like, the Steiners were ahead of their time, but for what, you know, I don't know. The tag team wrestling, I guess, changes over that time frame. And, you know, because the Road Warriors are done, Rock and Roll Express are done, Midnights are done, and it's kind of this transition phase for tag team wrestling. But what a run in those early.
Did you ever see any of those shows, the Super Shows from Japan?
Like the Japanese version of them?
No. The comedy is in the American versions of them.
Yeah.
Because they had Arn Anderson has kind of like this geisha girl outfit that he's trying on in the mirror. Like they're at the mall, right? And he's like checking his figure and everything. And I'm like, what the hell's going on here? And then they have this big buffet of nothing but sushi, where like a bunch of American executives are like you know, scouting the sushi, and they're not actually grabbing it. They're just kind of like looking at it and touching it. It's a very awkward start to the video. And then, of course, Jim Ross, because at that time we lived in a different era, right? Let's just say that. He had to Americanize every Japanese wrestler because we were all dumb, right? So Tatsumi Fujinami was never called the Dragon in his life. But because in the South, right, at that time, Jim Ross is like, well, if they think Dragon, they think Japanese. So he starts calling him Dragon Fujinami, like out of, and that always, even as a kid, that bothered me. I'm like, why? Why does he do that? Like, and then, you know, God help him with the names from the other wrestlers that were on the card. Like the two wrestlers that the Steiners wrestled on that show.
Hiroshi Hase and was it Chono?
No, no, that was the year before where they actually ended up stiffing the young Japanese wrestler. I think it was Izuka.
Okay.
It was horrible.
I used to get a kick out of those shows because now it's normalized now. Like we see Japanese wrestling all the time. So it's not unique really in any way. But back then, I didn't have any access to New Japan or All Japan. I was just watching through WCW. And then they can play into sort of the mystery of there's wrestling outside of the U.S. And so your mind goes like, I wonder what it looks like. Is it different? Who's the top guy? What are the moves like? And so there's like a lot of mystery. And those shows, you know, they whet the appetite, even though what you would realize is that the New Japan show's like 5 hours. And then you get like this 90-minute version on a US $10 pay-per-view or whatever. So
right. But
fascinating times in the early 90s.
I guess me being exposed to lucha early on and the Spanish networks, I didn't have that kind of connection to Japanese wrestling just because I already knew there was other wrestling around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously when I started reading like PWI magazine, they talk about New Japan. The only thing that was cool with me as a huge baseball fan is seeing wrestlers come out of the dugout at the Tokyo. I had never seen that. And I was like, that's so cool. Like my two favorite, like, I guess you could say sports, like they merge because the wrestlers are coming out of the dugout, you know, it was just cool. And then I remember the Tokyo Dome. Did you ever see that movie with Tom Selleck, Mr. 3000?
Yeah. Mr. Baseball. It's called Mr. Baseball.
Mr. Baseball. He's playing for the Tigers from Tokyo and they show the Tokyo Dome, you know? So anyways, those are my memories from seeing the Tokyo Dome and wrestlers coming out of the dugout and stuff.
Isn't Frank Thomas the one who beats him out for his position in the bigs?
And yes. Yeah, Hall of Famer, Frank Thomas.
All right, back to this show. So Brian Pillman against Norman. Now, Norman, Mockum Singh in Calgary. Mm-hmm. And they bring him over and they give him a very Americanized like gimmick. And basically for this match, Dave said what they told him is go do your Calgary kind of match. Like just go all out. Don't do this version of Norman the Lunatic that you've been doing. We want this to be like a fire 5-minute match. I think it was actually 3 minutes. But Pillman and Norman kind of, This is maybe Norman's best match or whatever in his short stint in WCW. And Pillman wins the match. But Dave wrote, too short to be a 3-star match, but too good to be anything less than 3 stars. So I don't know what that means. What is the rating there, guy?
I don't know. But I think he also said the same thing with the 1-2-3 kid wrestler Jeff Jarrett at the King of the Ring 94, which was for a long time was considered probably the best 4-minute match in the history of American wrestling, to be honest with you. Yeah, Mockum Singh was the guy that was from Calgary, like you said. Always got saddled with the worst gimmicks, right? He was Norman the Lunatic here, which was essentially, you know, a special needs person later on, right? Because wrestling has a history of those kind of characters. And then, obviously, he would go on to, you know, more, I guess you could say, infamy as Bastion Booger.
Bastion Booger.
WWF in 93. What was sad about his career is that he was a really good worker that never got to show it because he was saddled with these gimmicks. And the reason why they booked this match at the Clash was because they were comfortable working with each other because Brian Pillman had started in Calgary and he had already wrestled Norman the Lunatic there. So they just brought it over. And like you said, they only gave him 4 minutes because the point was to get Brian Pillman over in this match. So, he was never really able to show what he could really do at the national stage.
Now, when you talk about wrestling today versus wrestling of yesteryears, we have the history of the moment and what happened. We know we can sort of study it. And today's wrestling, you know, I like to complain about certain things in the booking, but knowing that, you know, it doesn't really matter. People are going to buy the pay-per-views for the matches or whatever. But, you know, you want wrestling today to be popular. You want it to, how does it become popular? How do they become competitive? But the other reason why Pillman faces off against Norman is because who are they setting him up for? They're setting him up for Luger, and Luger is a big guy, and you want to establish that Pillman can beat someone who is larger than him, and he's not just a junior heavyweight. So in the buildup to his feud with Luger, you have him beat somebody of, you know, a bigger size than him, which is very smart. And, you know, the reason why I'm saying this is because AEW is currently doing the storyline where Mercedes has a heater in Camille. And so if you do this thing correctly, like, Camille shouldn't sell for anybody for 3 to 6 months. And then when you have the person who's getting ready to face Mercedes, that being Chris Statlander at this point, then if Statlander can get through Camille, then you're like, oh my gosh, she's built up for Mercedes. But when you have Camille, you know, getting clothesline over the top rope every other show, you're like, eh, this is not working quite as good as I wanted it to work. So, but I liked that detail, that level of detail to the Brian Pillman thing.
Yeah, and to me, that gimmick, that whole bodyguard, you know, heater gimmick, it rarely fails. That gimmick always gets over. It always works. You know, it worked with Roman Reigns in The Shield. It worked with Kevin Nash.
Nash's entire career is built off of that gimmick.
Right. It revitalized Sid's career with HBK. You could go on and on and on.
Dave Batista, to an extent, was kind of the heater gimmick. He wasn't actually a bodyguard, but he was kind of like the big guy for the Evolution group.
Right. Travis Tomko, of all fucking people. Like, he got over. No, I mean, not mainly went over. And so it's like, yeah, that gimmick it works because they don't say anything. They just stand there. They don't sell. It's going to work. But with her, with Camille, it's just not working because she has to sell all the time.
Yeah, and maybe the one that we didn't even mention, maybe the best one of all as far as memorability, is Chyna. Like, she's a woman, and she didn't sell, you know, China forever. So, and it just worked out for her. All right, so the next match, Steve Williams against Mike Rotunda. This is like the JR masturbatory match where he can just talk about all the the college backgrounds and stuff. Mike.
Right.
And I mean, it was actually really cool seeing Dr. Death press this dude over his head like 5 times in a row. Dr. Death wins match. And in my I know the main event was really good, but when I watched this back, I was like, man, this match is really good. Lex Luger and Tommy Rich, of all people. Now, Lex, you know, Lex has pockets of his career that
I was going to say, we're in the middle of the real Lex Express.
This is the best Lex in 89. Ever.
He's on a hell of a run here. And so, yeah, it's not surprising to me that you know, him and Tommy Rich had such a good match.
It was so good. Now the finish is a little funky in that Tommy Rich he punched the post, but then after punching the post, he still got the sleeper hold on Lex, so his hand wasn't hurt there. But then Lex dropped his throat over the top rope, and then he pinned him.
I'm going through my review here to see if Dave cuts a promo on Tommy Rich for not selling that pole shot like he did on Gunther,
of course, you
know, a few months ago.
Of course. the post spot, I mean, selling in wrestling today is so different because the idea of selling is to really be a transition into whatever the next move is, because you're selling the moves way more today than ever. And this was kind of like, it kind of worked in how wrestling today works, in that Tommy Rich went to one thing, but he had to get to the next spot. So, oh, we kind of forget about that. And we got to get to the one that's going to pop the crowd. And right. People like Dave are going to call that out. And I imagine the 5,000 or how many ever people were in that building, they probably didn't care at all. They just wanted to see if Tommy Rich was going to win the match.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's yes.
All right, main event. Ric Flair and Sting beat Dick Slater and the Great Muta. Dick Slater's actually on his way out as well. That'll be a little bit more of a focus in the next couple months. But
yeah.
And so the match was really good. It was really heated. It's interesting to me. Now, I wanted to get your thoughts on this because I used to see guys like Dick Slater, Dick Murdoch, And for whatever reason, the fact that they never stuck around territories for a long time actually was really cool, because they just seemed like outsiders, like just, you know, butt kickers who would they could bring in, and all of a sudden you just believed in them. Now, when I watch back Dick Slater, some of that magic is gone a little bit, some of the goofy selling that he does. But still, like, his name meant something, and I think it was part of the reason why this match was so heated. You would think, going from a Terry Funk to a Dick Slater, maybe the crowd's a little deflated, but not this crowd. They were just as into this match as if Terry Funk, and it's probably worked better that Terry Funk's not in the match and he does run-in.
Yeah. Yeah, well, first of all, Dick Slater emulated his style after Terry Funk. If you talk from the selling and all that stuff. Yeah. But you're right. I just think that Dick Slater at this time, not so much a little while after this, but at this time, he's still a very, very good worker, you know? And so he knows how to work that crowd, and that's why he got over. But yeah, you were saying about Dick Slater, Dick Murdoch. I think Abdullah the Butcher is another one that would come and go. A lot of it was also because who they were backstage, too, because they were just these guys that just would just quit on the spot, or they would get somebody pissed off and they would get fired. So a lot of it was personality based. Stan Hansen was another one, but Stan Hansen had that big contract in Japan, so he couldn't stick around that long, even if he wanted to. But yeah, that though, I remember, yeah, those guys were always very unique guys. You know, they always stood out to me for the reason that you just said.
Yeah. Yeah. They were like outlaws in a sense, like,
right.
Just like, oh yeah, they're here for a short time. You know, they're here for a good time, not for a long time. okay. So that's the show. It was a really, really good clash. I thought, you know, that there's lots of things that Dave is detailing every week about things that they need to fix. But as a wrestling show, there wasn't much that they needed to fix on this show. It was very well done heading into the first ever Halloween Havoc, which we'll talk about next month.
I was gonna say, I think a lot of the first half of 89 always gets all the love, right, from the hardcores, and understandably so, right? It's got the classic trilogy,
it's got
Funk and Flair, you know, wrestling the Great American Bash. But the second half of 89, people sleep on it, but it's also very good, I think, more so from a booking perspective than a wrestling perspective. And so I really enjoy it, and it's going to get a lot better. It's going to get fun because, again, you know, you're intertwining a lot of the angles and storylines. Really, I think the only one that was doing that was like Bill Watts with Mid-South with his television show. We weren't seeing a lot of that yet. But going back to your previous question, I'm trying to think, did Vince allow like these outlaw guys to work his company? Because I can't remember, other than Kamala, because I know Kamala would come and go. I can't think of any wrestler who would do a couple months here, a couple months there in the WWF. I don't think Vince would allow those guys. Like, he wouldn't allow those kind of characters to come and go, right?
How long was Terry and Dory in WWF?
85. They did about a year.
Okay.
So it was a while. They did about a year.
Yeah.
85 to 86.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of who was... Who was the tag? Now, this is actually before Vince's national
four days or something in 84, so we can't count that.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on. So Dave says, or Dave writes, the Team of Doom or War and Doom is going to be the name of the tag team managed by both Kevin Sullivan and Robin Green. But he does mention it's going to be Butch Reed and Ron Simmons. And, you know, I don't know if you remember those masks, but they weren't really trying to hide their faces that much. And I was wondering why. Like, did they want us to know who those guys were, do you think?
Yeah, because eventually they were Doom without the mask. So they got on mask, and then they were just Ron Simmons and Butch Reed as Doom.
Yeah.
Before they broke up.
Yeah. It's just like if with a little bit of hindsight, you look like Butch Reed is more famous than Ron Simmons at this point. So he's more memorable. But then, you know, they wouldn't really talk. So I guess you couldn't give out, you know, hear the voice or whatever. So there was some mystery.
Also keep in mind that at that time, they didn't care about that. At that time, you just had to accept the new gimmick. Because remember, when Barry Darso became the Repo Man, like, he had the big eagle tattoo. It was the same tattoo that Smash had, you know? I mean, to me, the one is like Crush. Crush is like Crush from Demolition, and then he's Hawaiian Crush, but it's supposed to be a different guy. Yeah. And so I don't think at that time, and there was the internet wasn't around then. So, again, people forget that these promoters, they thought very little of the fan base. So,
they thought they were idiots. Like, yes, or they thought that, you know, they kind of fans cycle. They don't stay long. Like, you have new ones like every other couple years or something.
Yes. And then also they probably felt like nobody's going to remember Ron Simmons. You know, nobody's going to. I mean, maybe Butch Reed, because like you said, Butch Reed was a star.
Yeah.
Elsewhere. But they didn't care, you know. So I think we're overthinking it when we're trying to see why the mask kind of still reveals who they were. They just didn't care.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's exactly what you said.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.
So, okay, so Paul Lee is fired. The reason he's fired is because he gets in an argument with the Nature Boy about his future. And so Rick just, you know, do you know who I am? I'm Ric Flair. Let's Paul Lee go. And Paul Lee was working as Flair's booking assistant. And who becomes his new booking assistant? Well, none other than James E. Cornette.
Uh-oh.
And Dave wrote, some of the veterans were unhappy because they don't like to take orders from someone who wasn't a veteran wrestler himself and someone who was in their 20s and is not an athlete. So they didn't want this nerdy, non-athletic dude who could talk his ass off telling them what to do.
Yeah, but that's BS, because he drew money in Mid-South. Yeah. Like, his talking ability actually drew money to the point where James Cornette has a book with all his check receipts where he shows you that he drew money.
Yep.
And it's like, to me, it's like Paul Lee Dangerously is less qualified than James E. Cornette at this point. So I don't know what the big deal is. And they're the same age. So it's just, you know, it's just the veterans being veteran. You know, they're always going to complain about something.
My favorite Jim Cornette line about Paul Heyman was that Paul Heyman would rather climb a tree and lie than stand on the ground and tell the truth. I love Paul.
Yeah, he's got a bunch of those.
All right. So here's one that I just pulled out for you, because we had talked about the Slammers Wrestling. Like, that's literally all of WCW and WWF for September. It was a very slow month. But Vern Langdon is opening a Slammers Wrestling gym in Sun Valley, California, with the Fabulous Moolah as the head wrestling trainer. They had a party for the grand opening, which included Moolah, ACCW promoter Joe Palumbo, Mike Mazurki, and Gene LaBelle, and others. Now, how many of these gyms existed?
It was just one. The Slammers gym was just one. But it's interesting that you say that, because all the names that you just mentioned, those are the roots, the very beginning of PWG.
Interesting.
Because the original PWG 6, right, with Joey Ryan, Super Dragon, a Disco Machine, all of them, Excalibur, they all trained with a guy called Ron Rivera from Revolution Pro, who trained at Slammers. So you see the roots of what would become the Southern California independent scene right there. Interesting stuff.
So if you know Dave Meltzer, you also know that he was a fan of roller derby, and he really enjoyed his roller derby.
Like, and you said, anybody that knows Dave knows that.
And we just had a discussion about a roller derby star on Friday's Wrestling
Observer. I would never know who Ann Covello was if it wasn't for Dave.
That was a fantastic bio that he wrote about her too. I was like, wow, she's really interesting. You know, Ann Covello, because she's from the Bay Area, she would call in on one of the Bay Area call-in shows during the afternoon. And the guy who did it, he played basketball at UNLV under Jerry Tarkanian and then became kind of a big shot on television news out here in the Bay Area. So he's kind of a big, you know, he's kind of a big wig. And she would call in and, you know, she was probably in her 60s at this point. And they would kind of flirt on the air and, you know, she would talk about, oh, yeah, she's sunbathing on the roof, you know, because that was kind of her gimmick, was she just had like this really leathery orange skin. Yeah, but I just remember Elk and Calvello, and then Dave writes this by. I was like, wow, that's the same woman who I used to hear call in on these radio shows. So the Roller Games is debuting, and the only thing Dave really writes about the Roller Games debut, because he basically said, you know, I'm not going to turn this into Roller Games.
Yes, I read newsletter. That.
Yeah. He said that they were getting a lot of money to do these televised tapings, but then he gave every single reason why it was going to fail. There's going to be interest early on, and then they're not going to be able to book the thing to make it that interesting because roller derby is a little outdated and, you know, people have wrestling for that now and you have other things. And one of those other things was a show that I grew up on, because it was very similar to pro wrestling, none other than the American Gladiators. Did you used to watch that show when you were a kid?
I loved it. Nitro was my guy. You know?
Yeah.
And I saw the documentary on Netflix.
How is the documentary? Because there's two of them. There's one on Netflix and there's one on ESPN. I haven't watched them yet.
I haven't seen the ESPN one. The Netflix one is good. It's what they do, right? So it's a 4-part documentary. It goes through all the years, the legacy, all that stuff. They find a lot of the gladiators and they talk to them. Yeah, I love that show. That one, and then you might have been a little too old for the ninja show where they had the ninjas in the soundstage.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
Yeah, that one was in the mid-90s. So okay. I was like 12, 13 around there. But that was another big hit in the syndication era. But yeah, I'm a big fan of American Gladiators. Love that show.
All right. Is that all? Oh, okay. So now I guess we get to go. We don't have very much of only in the.
So nothing's happening in the WWF?
No, nothing. There's nothing.
There is something. There is something. Dave has a hard time understanding how Zeus could come back after the job he did at SummerSlam.
Yeah, they're kind of retconning the finish so that Survivor Series. Like, they're not showing Zeus taking the pin on the build up to Survivor Series.
Right. And then he's speculating that the December paper was going to be taped, which ended up becoming a reality.
Yeah.
And also, it's interesting because when he's going through the Survivor Series teams, because the Survivor Series lineups, the preliminary lineups have been announced.
Yeah.
He is not the Ultimate Warrior against Andre's team. Is the Ultimate Warrior against Bobby Heenan's team.
Yeah, yes.
Now, what's interesting to me about that, and we'll get to when we cover the show, is that Tully wouldn't get fired up until that day, which meant Bobby had to wrestle.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if he was going to wrestle anyway, and maybe he was going to wrestle for Andre, who couldn't move at this point. You know, so I'm wondering about that because...
Yo, that's interesting. I didn't think... That might be something I could ask Dave about today.
Ask Dave, see if he remembers 35 years later.
Yeah.
Because that's what shocked me. That's what stood out. Because it was like, why is it already called the Bobby Heenan team when we didn't know he had to wrestle that night? It was when Tully got popped, you know, and he got fired. So that's interesting. So maybe he was going to wrestle. But that means the only one that he would take the place of would be Andre. You know?
Yes.
Because Andre would only last like 10 seconds in that match. I don't know if you remember that match. But
I don't remember that match.
It was essentially the house show matches, except in Survivor Series form, okay. where Warrior just clotheslined them out and he got coming out. He was the first guy eliminated in like 10 seconds.
All right.
But you see it eventually. But yeah, that's out to me.
All right. If for your hard out here, your Billy Kidman hard out.
I still got a couple more minutes if you want.
Okay. Because we do have a question. No pressure. I don't know if Jay Boba is still on, but he has a WWE ID question. I don't know if you looked into what they're doing there.
No, tell me about it. I've been so busy with this World Series.
No, I'm with you. I'm with you. I haven't really read up on it too much. I have I kind of an understanding of it, but we'll get to that question after we do our favorite segment.
How's it going, everybody? Dave Meltzer here for the next 2 hours. We're going to be talking pro wrestling.
All right. Only in the Observer. Okay. So we've talked about the, you know, 30-year-old version of Dave versus, you know, the Dave now, and how comedy has changed. And
the fabulous moolah is what I got to say.
So when he was writing about this Roller Games, he was saying the idea was that this promoter promised that his women skaters would be babes instead of old hags. That is, I don't know if that's what the guy said and Dave quoted him, or if that was Dave's, that was basically Dave saying, you know, we're not going to have these older women skating on the show. We're trying to draw new eyeballs.
Either or, right? At this point in time, it could be either or.
All right. Now, there are two people who Dave generally, it can be the butt of his joke. Dusty Rhodes is often the butt of his joke. Kerry Von Erich has been the butt of his joke a few times, and we'll get to a Kerry one because there's a Kerry one coming. But he's mentioned Dump Matsumoto a couple times in the Observer, and he mentioned a Dump Matsumoto game show in which He writes, American Gladiators is actually based on a popular Japanese game show, which Dump Matsumoto frequently appears on. Have you heard this story at all about Dump Matsumoto kind of being involved in this game? I was like, what? Where does that come from?
I'm gonna have to watch that Netflix show they have on her to see if that's something they cover.
I don't think they do. I'm actually I'm on the last two episodes, but I've been on the last two episodes forever. But you should definitely watch it. It's really good.
Yeah, well,
I think you'll like it just from the storytelling of wrestling aspect of it, because they do a really good job of showing the storytelling in the ring when it comes to the stuff that is going on in their political, you know, being the top woman or whatever. All that stuff is played out very well in the ring. So I think you would like it. Okay. He also says the Cleveland rock band called The Bastard Squad has written a song called If I Only Had a Brain. And when they perform it, they dedicate it to Kerry Von Erich. and he said seriously, as if, I'm not joking. This, they dedicated to Kerry Von Erich, the Bastard Squad. We have to find this song.
Well, Kerry would give us a lot of reasons, you know, to believe that if you put your ear next to his, you'll hear the ocean. Let's just put it that way. yes.
All right. Last one here. I told you it was quick. Prelim wrestler Dale Vesey, whose gimmick, ironically, is of the State Patrol tag team, was arrested this past week for theft and extortion and trying to intimidate a witness in regards to his arrest in August on charge of selling steroids. So the State Patrol gimmick was not a shoot, because this guy was actually not a good dude and was getting arrested himself. So.
Or maybe it was a shoot, depending on your political stances. You know? That's all I'll say about that.
Okay, so let's get to the question. So WWE ID, I need my Observer story on this, because I'm sure Dave's going to have tons of details that was not in the press release. But what it sounds like is WWE has picked, I think it's like six independent promotions that they're going to work very closely with. And people can sign up to be a part of this program. And they are going to wrestle in these at these six indies, and it's basically a chance to get on WWE's radar. So Booker T's Reality of Wrestling in Houston, Cody Rhodes' Nightmare Factory in Atlanta, What they didn't say is the other person who runs the Nightmare Factory with Cody is actually an AEW wrestler, QT Marshall.
QT Marshall.
Seth Rollins is Black and Brave Academy in Iowa.
So pretty much you already have a connection to get into the WWE just by being in that school.
Yes.
You know?
Elite Pro Wrestling in Concord, New Hampshire, and Knox Pro Academy in LA are the first WWE ID schools to earn official designation. So WWE will send these prospects to these organizations, I believe, and they're going to, you know, they're promising, you know, high class training and all this stuff. But I think the thing that people are wondering about isn't that what the Performance Center is for? Don't they already have a school in which they do this? And so people are kind of wondering, okay, so what happens to the Performance Center? Now, I think the naysayers who don't like this idea are basically worried that their independence that they know and love and independent wrestling as it exists today will change because a lot of the top wrestlers will not be available to work their regular shows because they'll be, you know, in these six independents. So that is, you know, I don't know too much more about that. I know that when WWE went to the UK and tried to instill this thing where they kind of took over or were partnering with some of these independent organizations, it kind of killed the UK indies as well right. as the pandemic. The pandemic did as well, kind of hurt that culture, that pro wrestling culture. So I don't know if it's good or bad. I just think it's one of those things where WWE has this idea and then they kind of put it in motion. And we'll only know if it works is if they keep doing it. And then if it doesn't, they'll stop doing it and they won't talk about it. I imagine it is probably something that they already kind of do with Booker. Like, you know, we always hear about Booker getting like some of these NXT folks and stuff. So I would imagine they're probably doing a version of this already, but now they're kind of expanding it to these other schools. So I don't know. I don't know if it's going to hurt the indies as much as people realize, but if it takes off and if it becomes a big success, then yeah, I'd probably be worried about seeing my local, you know, like kind of like when you know, in 5 years ago when
I don't think Premier Wrestling is in any danger of getting
Premier Wrestling doesn't exist, but the 2013 version of Premier Wrestling would have probably just been done because Jeff Cobb was his top guy. And Jeff Cobb would have been picked up immediately. Jeff Cobb now in New Japan. And other guys that were working there, like Timothy Thatcher. Referees as well. I forget what Tom Caster's NXT name is, like Derek something or other. But
right.
He worked in Premier. So, yeah, but it would be like that if you go back to 2013. They would immediately grab Jeff Cobb, and then he wouldn't be working Premier. So.
Right, so I'm trying to do some quick reading on this program here as you're talking. It sounds like it's going to be more focused on, like, beginners, right? Because it's really focused on the term of, you know, the terminology of, like, school, students. I'm reading the, the press release. Now, I guess the concern from the hardcores is that is it going to eventually evolve into WWE style, right? Because everybody over the years is going to merge towards that style because they all want to go to these schools. That concern I understand. But if your concern is that if the elite independent guys out there are going to eventually change their style to fit into those schools, I don't think that's going to happen. I think this is more an investment in the future, and they want to recruit like athletes, like football players, etc., to mold them their way, right? So that's really what it's going to be about. Now, yes, there is going to be a ripple effect because if everybody sees that's what they're looking for, the entire independence scene is going to turn to that because that's, you know, you already have an in if you do it that their way. So that is concerning. As far as NXT already being an outlet for that, I also think there's been this whole conversation about less house shows, right? Less performing in front of a live audience. So they got to get their NXT students out there to different schools as well. So I think getting them some matches at Booker's school or at Seth Rollins' school, is beneficial to NXT because, you know, they need to get that those miles in, right? So so in that part, I agree with the program. I'm very concerned. I'm actually very concerned about less house shows, not because I don't get to be there or see them or whatever, because I wouldn't even go to a house show nowadays. But these you have to be able to work to get better, and then you also I do believe that being on the road galvanizes you from injuries. You know, we see all these guys that are working once, twice a month now that are constantly getting hurt. You know, when you're on the road, you're on that grind, right? You're in that flow, so you don't get hurt as much. So that's going to be concerning. And that's the first time in our history in a long time that we have that. So for these younger talent to be able to have other places to work, I think it's going to be beneficial to them. I also think that they're talking more about just people starting from scratch, you know? The only fear, of course, like I said earlier, is if the entire indie scene becomes what WWE style, because that's their way in. But I feel like we're, I don't know, maybe 2-3 years down, you know, from even worrying about that.
So the counter, not the counterpoint, but the counter in wrestling is, what does Tony Khan do? Because he doesn't have a system like that to prepare the next generation of AEW stars. And he's got a lot of money coming in from his television deal. And you do wonder if that is something that he is looking at doing. You know, some people go, well, he can do it with ROH. I think he's still trying to get a TV deal with ROH. But if they can't, and ROH becomes their school, and maybe Dustin, you know, is involved in some way, but I think Dustin has his own school, right? Or does he work with, he doesn't work with Cody's school. He does his own thing. I think
he does his own thing in Texas.
Yeah. So, you know, maybe Dustin's school is the one that you kind of feed into, but this is where, you know, we talked about, what can AEW do? Well, whether or not you like the television, you know, I like a lot of it. I don't like all of it, but the other thing is infrastructure. Now that is the hard part. WWE is a machine. They have all of these people working for them in different departments. AEW doesn't have that. They are a pro wrestling company more than they are an entertainment company. This is one of those things when it comes to the infrastructure of building out something to where you can actually run a school, or you can run your developmental and you can feed into AEW. So that is something that I'm interested to see if Tony Khan is interested in doing. Because if WWE does eat up a lot of the indies, where's Tony Khan's folks going to come from? Where are the new wrestlers going to come from? Well, he's going to have to kind of create his own space for that.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting. I was talking to one of my best friends who's connected into the world of independent wrestling here. And he was telling me how there's actually people that are trying to either buy the rights to a pro wrestling gorilla,
uh-huh,
or maybe get Super Dragon to just relinquish them, because really all it is the name. There's no television. So, but when we're having this conversation, I asked them, so like the Blu-ray format is dead, right? You can't go to that format anymore, and that's what PWG was surviving on.
Right.
And then you can't stream, because then you're not going to get any of Tony's guys, because he's not going to allow his guys to be on the internet. So I don't think the PWG formula would work today. It just won't work, because even you have to give the fan base what Super Dragon was giving them, right? Which was these elite level performers, I should say, you know, from match one all the way to match six or seven. But even if you wanted to, this is connected to the topic that me and you are talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we wanted to, Who's out there that's not under contract that's an elite top level indie performer right now? I couldn't think of. I mean, there's some luchadors, sure, but I can't think of anyone who's.
They're
out
all
there.
Older guys.
Yeah,
Mike Bailey, Speedball,
right?
Matt Cardona, who's the ultimate like independent guy.
Yeah,
but there's people like that. You know, they'll get bookings here and there. You'll see a lot of the indie folks on ROH, like I don't know if someone like Trisha Dora is signed elsewhere. I don't think she is, unless Tony has her on some ROH deal. But, you know, she's someone where I go, huh, how come she's not on anybody's radar? Because I think she's good. She's not the best, but she's really good. But folks like that are out there. But yeah, like I think where the movement is going is in finding the athletes before they actually become wrestlers, which is what WWE is doing, and trying to build them into wrestlers. Now, I don't know if you exactly have to do it like that, but I mean, how long has WWE been scouting amateur wrestling? Forever. Like,
right.
Since as far as I, you know, Jim Ross and Jerry Briscoe and all those guys would go to the amateur wrestling meets to scout folks. So you can create these opportunities, but Tony just doesn't have the power and the infrastructure to do that yet. Well, now he's got the money, but we'll see. Can you hire the right people? Can you actually build out your company instead of just the wrestling people? And you know, so that'll be interesting.
That's gonna be a very interesting thing to look out for the next 3 years, because you know, and me and you were talking texting the other day. I'm really concerned about AEW. You know, I know they got the little cushion, right? We all know they're not going anywhere. And truth be told, even if they didn't have that cushion, they weren't going anywhere either. Tony was going to continue pumping money. But, you know, I think there's a lot of, like, nuance in what's happening. And we don't look at that. We're either looking at they're making money or not. But mm-hmm. No, but there is legitimate concerns because they're not popular right now. And that brings a lot of problems, right? It brings – because they're also not cool. You could be cool and not be popular, right? ECW is a great example of that. But they don't even have that cool factor they used to have anymore. And so I don't know what the new bottom is for them without them going out of business, which is so weird because I think this is the only time in history where that could even exist, this idea that you bottom out and you don't have to worry about going out of business. It's weird to me, you know? And so I don't know how that's going to look like. Are they going to start taping at a studio? Are they going to start? Because now we're looking at 900 tickets. Some of these places only have 900 tickets out. And it just, I mean, those collisions, man, like, they just, I told you the other day, like, I saw that lineup for this past weekend, and I'm like, I wouldn't even go for free, you know?
Nope.
There's nothing in that lineup that tells me, come and watch this wrestling. There's nothing. Now, I can't say that for Dynamite. Dynamite's different. Dynamite is, you know, great lineups, top-level guys. But Collision is just such a throwaway show. And I hope that changes with this new contracts kicking in next year, because I really don't see why you can't have his top guys on both shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, you're paying all this money to these guys to work one day a week
and then two on pay-per-view days. And it's like, at minimum, they should work both days, you know? And not only are people going to want to go to the arenas, but, you know, you're going to get more viewers because, you know, you could see Hangman and Swerve on both shows, you know?
Yeah.
You use Dynamite to build Collision and use Collision to build Dynamite. And you're going to have – but anyways – I'm not the one with the $170 million contract, so, you know. but I'm very concerned. With that said, like I said, they do have the seats for a pretty hot angle coming up here, and we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, I was really bummed because they came to San Jose, and this was right after the pay-per-view, and we got the B-level Dynamite, so I was pretty disappointed. And no card, you know, except for like 3 days before we finally got our first match. So, you know, I just, if you're going to a market and you give them the B level show, they're not going to be that interested to come the next time. So I'm a little bit worried about stuff like that, where you kind of have to, like, that first impression, man, it's gotta be a good one. Cause we get Raw here all the time. We've had three Raws in the last 2 years. And it feels like a rock concert by comparison. And it doesn't mean that the shows are fantastic or anything, but just like the ambiance of it.
Yeah.
It feels important. The fans are there and they're having a good time. and this Dynamite that I watched, which was not the worst wrestling show, by the way, that I've ever been to, because there's been some really bad Raws here over the years. They've really figured out how to do Raw really well. But at the same time, it was like just like wrestling fans, and that's it. Like, you had to be a wrestling fan to be at that show. Like, you had to be one of the hardcores to be there. And it was, I just felt like it was not the place to be in the Bay Area that day.
So that's a big problem. And hopefully that's something, like I said, they have more finances now. They could figure something out. Look at WWE. Every time you go to a SmackDown taping or a Raw taping, I'm all into my whole thing is like just looking at the whole card, right? So you have Cody Rhodes. He wrestles pretty much at every show, but people don't see that, you know? And
yeah, he wrestles dark.
Yeah, he's been wrestling in Solo Sikoa lately in street fight matches. So that's the top guy in wrestling, not just in WWE. If he could go out there every Monday, every Friday, and close the show and send the fans home happy with a main event match, why can't Hangman do that, or Swerve, or MJF, you know? Even if it's a comedy match, you know, those Steve Austin dark matches from 2001, he didn't do shit in the ring anymore. He was out there, you know, being a comedy wrestler. That's fine.
Call and response with the crowd.
Yeah, that's fine. Just give us the big names, you know.
You know why they can't do that on AEW is because, so they tape the show, and then after the show is over, you've got like some Rampage matches, or you have some ROH matches. And so he's just padding the fans that are there, and he's coming out saying stuff like, I hope you all stick around after Dynamite, because we have some of the top wrestlers in the world wrestling tonight for you. So stick around. And then when you realize you're waiting, and you're like, oh, it's MXM against Private Party in the main event of this whatever. So to me, now I don't know how people feel like that, but when he does stuff like that, I go, how can I ever trust this guy to come out and open his mouth again when that's what he says and that's what I see? But on the to further the point is, he wants to pad because he's got these ROH shows that he puts on the streaming network, or he's got Rampage that he's got to put on Friday, so he's got to tape all this stuff. So what he's doing is he's getting all that stuff on tape, but not doing what you're saying, which is then bringing out the top guy and making the people who stuck around feel like they really got something important.
Remember, Hogan would always come out after 4 hours of squash matches. Hogan would come out at the end for his 8-minute match and send the fans home happy. Even I don't care if the show goes 5 hours. You're taping Rampage, Ring of Honor, Dynamite. Give me a 6-minute Hangman versus Swerve match. Even if they're out there doing spinneroonies. Like, notice the difference when the fans are exiting if they get those 6 minutes of the top guys. Just go out there and bullshit for 6 minutes, do the funky roll-up, and go home, you know? Instead of ending with like you said, the models and Private Party, you know, because to me, I see some of these results, and I see like the last match of the night, it'll be like Athena versus somebody, and I'm like, that's it. Like, you just go home after that. Like, that's so weird, you know. And that's one of the many reasons why these shows ain't working right now.
Yeah, our guy right here, Eddie DiBiase, also agreed and said the San Jose AEW show was pretty disappointing.
Yeah,
I didn't see him though. I haven't seen Eddie DiBiase in a long time.
Eddie, look who won the World Series tonight. That's all I got to tell you, brother. And another thing, you guys, I mean, because Eddie likes to throw that whole one every other year gimmick to me all the time, but we're catching up now. If we could win another one in the next couple of years, we're almost gonna be there with you guys. So
well, it depends if you count 2020, because some people don't count it. That's why I was asking you. I was asking you if you counted it. Do the diehard Dodger fans count that one? But you know, the other thing that's crazy is one of the other ones that people didn't count. You guys won that one too in 1981.
Yeah, the strike one.
Yeah, so we got two of those.
We beat the Yankees on that one.
I think it was the Yankees again, yeah.
Right.
All right. I think we're good here. You get to go watch a lot of the post game stuff that you missed to come on with us and enjoy yourself at the parade. I've had parade my favorite one, my favorite Giants parade, because where I worked,
listen to you now.
Well, this relates to wrestling. Where I worked, the parade came right in front of our building on the same street. And if you remember, Hunter Pence and Daniel Bryan had the yes chant stuff going.
Yeah.
So I got to see Daniel Bryan doing the yes chant in one of the cars right in front of my building. So
you didn't have to take the day off. They're just rolling.
No, it was just right in front of my building. Yeah, I didn't have to take the day off.
Yeah. Well, we're gonna get ours on Friday. I'm excited.
You got yours right here. You got your Let's Go Dodgers right here.
Yeah, he's from LA too. So good. Yeah, Mario, we did it. Before we go now, I want to bring you something else. WrestleMania.
Yeah.
What are you thinking? Are you going to be there or?
So I want to be there for some of the weekend. I just don't know if I'm. Did you see the prices of tickets for that show?
They're ridiculous, man.
Yeah, I mean, I think I could probably get in if I wanted to get in, like, as media. I don't think that would be a problem, but I don't know. If I'm going to go to that show, I kind of want to hang out with my friends. I don't want to just sit in, like, a press box or something.
Right.
So, I don't know about that. I think I'm going to be there because Thursday and Friday, my main thing will be to kind of network with a lot of the people who do the stuff that I do. And I kind of just want to network with them and hang out and have a good time and Wally Mania and all that stuff.
Right.
But as far as the actual WrestleMania shows, I'm not sure yet.
So you would come back home on Saturday.
Maybe, or maybe I'll watch it somewhere Saturday.
Or something.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah. Cause this is Vegas. They'll have it somewhere. I really honestly believe after the whole UFC thing, I mean, UFC got me to watch them after 10 years, bro. So
the Sphere.
They need to run the Sphere because look, I know it's ridiculous. I know. I think Dave was saying that I think they've got the number wrong just because it sounds so outrageous because you have to give some sort of, you have to leave room for some sort of profit margin for these people that are coming in. But he did say it was $250,000 to rent it, right? Which I don't know if I believe that. Not that Dave's lying. It's just I think he got the wrong information or he made a mistake. But even if it's expensive, we already know that these fans are gonna pay whatever they gotta pay to get in. So run it and do. Imagine the Hall of Fame at the Sphere. Look at those videos, and we know WWE is great with production. I could just imagine the great videos that they would show on that thing.
They have a hard time selling out the Hall of Fame at like a normal stadium, though, or a normal arena. That's not the show that they could actually get the eyeballs on.
But now you get the gimmick where you get SmackDown and the Hall of Fame.
Well, I was thinking the one show, because they can't run actual WrestleMania there because you need to run it in the with the 60,000 people or whatever.
Yeah.
You might be able to get away with running the Raw after WrestleMania, though. Because people are always going to want to stick around for that show.
Right. Well, I would do it too. Yeah, I mean, do that one. And with Netflix, you know, who knows? We don't even know how long those shows are going to be nowadays. So anyways, I'm going to be there just because it seems like an exciting just whole weekend. Like
it's going to be the place to be for sure.
Right. And it's 3.5 hours for me. Like you said, though, whether or not I'm going to be at WrestleMania is a different story. Because those prices are not cheap. And right now with both AEW and with Triple H's company, like I feel like we're not getting our money's worth in a lot of ways. Although Paul's learning though, because this next show has seven matches. And it seems like they have repercussions. It's not going to be a regular in your house. Like we've been clowning them.
Yeah.
So that's good. And also, his storylines are picking up again. I'm back into the whole bloodline thing is getting interesting. I don't know how this guy keeps it going, man. I mean, it's just you're thinking they're getting cold, and then he just does something, and they go back up. You know,
they're gonna be fine next year because they'll have Cena, Rock will, come through every once in a while. But you know, I think Dave's reporting may have ruffled some feathers by old Dwayne there, though, of that Dwayne's not locked into to actually wrestling at the show. And I saw Dwayne wrote on somebody's Instagram post that it was bullshit, and so he may have cornered him. He may have you know, put himself in a corner by having to do something. But it does sound like his schedule is actually not going to allow himself to get into the ring shape that he got into last year, which is why he wrestled.
Yeah, no, I think every time, I mean, history has proven that Dave is usually right when it comes to this. And these wrestlers, they just got to say what they got to say in the moment. You know what I mean? Remember Savage had that big old mummy on his elbow, and he was calling Dave a liar for saying he had a busted elbow when he actually did have, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So, I believe Dave. If Dwayne ain't going to be there, he's probably not going to be there. Or maybe just to save face, he'll come out for that 15-minute let's kill the wrestler's time cues promo that he likes to do in these shows, you know? Maybe we'll get that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
All right, man. Enjoy yourself. My biggest fear is that it becomes a routine rather than a special occasion for your team to win the World Series. So,
oh, I could live with that.
Yeah, I know you could. All right. Thanks to everyone for checking us out live on YouTube and for listening on the audio version. We'll be back talking October, so Halloween Havoc, which is the big show in October, but we'll be back hopefully sooner than later. The reason why we were so delayed is because playoff baseball is time-consuming. Yes. And I understood because I've had to do that too. So,
but are you like me where you had to watch all the games? See, a lot of people, a lot of these fake fans, they could keep up on their phones. I'm like, I
have actual writing. Every of the three Giants World Series, I wrote a story for whatever I was writing for back then. So I would watch the game and then spend another 2 hours after the game to write whatever the thing was that I was writing. So I recently went back and found some of those posts.
Cool, because we
celebrated the 10-year of Madison Bumgarner coming out of the bullpen to win Game 7. So I put that back up on
my ESPN
media website. So, all right. Have a good time. Have fun at the parade. We will see you when we see you. Peace out.
We know there's power in our numbers. We've seen the impact we make when we stand together. So let's stand with candidates who represent us in Washington, D.C., not extremist Bernie Moreno. If elected, Moreno could make the Radical Project 2025 playbook a reality, endangering our democracy and our hard-won rights and freedoms. Together, we can stop Moreno and his allies from reversing everything our ancestors fought for: Social Security, voting rights, and more. Sherrod Brown always stands up for the well-being of our community, capping the price of life-saving drugs like insulin and cracking down on predatory landlords jacking up rents in Black neighborhoods. Black power is in our votes. Let's use it today. Vote now to re-elect Senator Sherrod Brown.
Paid for by Ask Me People, AskMePeople.org, which is responsible for the content of this ad. Not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.
We've seen the impact we make when we stand together. So let's stand with candidates who represent us in Washington, D.C. Sherrod Brown always stands up for the well-being of our community, capping the price of insulin and cracking down on predatory landlords jacking up rents in Black neighborhoods. Black power is in our votes. Let's use it today. Vote now to re-elect Senator Sherrod Brown.
Paid for by Ask Me People, AskMePeople.org, which is responsible for the content of this ad, not authorized by any candidate or candidate's committee.